As we return to Sefer Shmuel, remember David's at a critical juncture. He's reconciled himself to the fact that he will not be building the Beis HaMikdash. To his great credit, he moves forward on that basis. And the last image that we had of David was the description of the Navi that he's doing Mishpat Utzdaka B'chol Yisrael. That David is living up to the vision. Charlotte, how are you? Wonderful to see you. Living up to the vision of the king, providing moral guidance. Good to see you, Susan. And even Leo now are coming in. Everybody's coming in. Wonderful to see everybody. And David is creating the kind of culture that we would look to the king to create. And this is true at the national level. And this chapter that we have in front of us this evening, I've called Promises Kept. Because David is about to manifest one of those qualities in life that is almost a binary phenomenon. And what I mean is the following. When it comes to the concept of loyalty, people are largely divisible into two different categories. There are people for whom loyalty means something, and then there are people for whom loyalty just doesn't mean something. And one of the great credits that we can say David has accrued is his sense of profound loyalty. Now, how do we measure loyalty? Loyalty can never be measured with respect to situations in which a person still has something to gain from that individual. In other words, let's say a person's colleague helped them in a particular way, and the person is, let's say they're an attorney, right? So, you know, somebody directed some business to a fellow attorney, and you can be grateful for that, so you send him some business back. That's not what I'm talking about in terms of loyalty, because you still stand to benefit from that, right? There's a quid pro quo going on there, and it could be very, I don't mean that in a malicious sense, I don't mean that in any kind of a nefarious sense, but the reality is, right, they're both still in a position to help each other. What I'm talking about when I talk about loyalty is I'm talking about somebody that cannot possibly help you anymore. Okay? This is a person that's far, far, far in the rearview mirror in life. And what you can do in life is you could basically divide people into these two categories. One category is, you know, this is a person that helped me, you know, climb the ladder of whatever ladder I'm trying to climb in life, professionally, socioeconomically, materially. And, you know, so I stepped on that ladder rung, and now I've moved on, right? And, you know, that person's now a non-entity to me. Or, in the case of David HaMelech, these debts are real. So what Paraktes is all about, as we'll see, is the sense that David has that the promises he made are promises that must be kept. And it's going to open up an entire new motif in Sefer Shmuel, which is the Mephibosheth motif. And we're going to meet Mephibosheth. We're going to see the complexity of his life, of what he represents. Physically, spiritually. And of course, what it really is about is about David's relationship with Yonatan. So let's just remind each other, and then we'll take a look at some of the sources inside, that Mephibosheth is the young son of Yonatan. He was 5 years old when his father was killed in battle against the Plishtim. And in the utter chaos that transpired in the wake of the terrible defeat of Shaul at the hands of the Plishtim, the battle in which Shaul, Yonatan, and two of Shaul's other sons die, the chaos that ensues. Mephibosheth is dropped. He is rendered incapable of walking. Piseach bishtei raglav. There's, some kind of a paraplegic as a result. And he then disappears from the text that we saw earlier. So now David goes on this search to find him, find some remnant of the house of Shaul. And we'll talk about the perspective that David comes from. But point number one is the question of loyalty, the question of promises kept. Okay, so let's take a look here. Go back to the original scene of the promise. Okay. This is now going all the way back. Sefer Shmuel Aleph, the 20th chapter, the 42nd verse. Vayomer Yonatan leDavid. Yonatan says to David, Lech l'shalom, go in peace. Remember, this is when they're in the field together. They've made the sign of the arrows. Shaul is fully committed to killing David. Yonatan says to David, Lech l'shalom, asher nishbanu shneinu anachnu b'shem Hashem, the oath that we took in God's name, l'mor, Hashem yeh b'ni u'v'necha, b'n zari u'v'n zaracha, ad olam. And that's it. The oath is between us, God knows about it, and remember they had made the agreement between themselves that they would be loyal to each other, not only in that generation, but for generations to come, vein zari uvein zaracha ad olam. Now again, Yonatan is dead. He can do nothing for David, by definition. The entire house of Shaul materially has been eradicated. So when we talk about David's motivation to try to repay this chesed that Yonatan did with David when David was in dire straits, it's a pure motivation. So, again, going back to the fourth chapter of now Shmuel Bet, this is the fourth verse, the Yonatan ben Shaul ben Echei Raglayim, Ben Chamei Shanim, he was 5 years old. Hayah bevo Shmuat Shaul v'Yonatan mi'Yisrael, when the news of the terrible defeat of Shaul and Yonatan came from the Jezreel Valley. Vatisa'eu omanto vatanos, and in the frenzy, in the chaos, in the utter upheaval. Vayihi b'chobza lanus, as she was running, we spent a lot of time, remember earlier this year, talking about that word, chipazon. Vayipol, there's a terrible accident, it's horrible. Vayipaseach, there's a life-changing injury. Ushmo Mephibosheth, this person's name is Mephibosheth, this child, this poor child who becomes disabled as a result of this horrific accident, sort of a tragedy within a tragedy of the defeat of the house of Shaul. Now again, last we saw of David, the 8th chapter here of Shmuel Bet, Vayimloch David al kol Yisrael, Vayi David osa mishpat utzdaka l'chol amo. Note and flag those words. L'chol amo. David is being portrayed as a national figure. Vayimloch David al kol Yisrael. So what Perek Tet is going to take us back to is not that macro national level, but David on the micro personal level, where David feels that there have been promises made, and he asks himself the hard question. Are promises made, promises kept? Have I honored my promise to Yonatan? Where is his family? Yonatan's family. You know, the Malbim has a fascinating essay. He says that literally anybody who was connected to the house of Shaul who wasn't dead at this time was in hiding. You'll see why the Malbim says that when you read the text of the Perek. It seems like people were really in hiding. They were afraid to be slaughtered. That's the way it worked in the ancient Near East in some countries to this very day. You know, when there's a change of regime, you know, people from the previous regime, as they say it in France, the ancien regime, right? They better go hide. There's going to be retribution. So Vayomer David, the beginning of chapter 9, Hachi Yesh Od. Is there any remnant? Asher notar levet Shaul? Is there anybody left? The Malbim says it's an honest question. He simply does not know whether there are survivors. Ve'asehimo chesed bavur Yehonatan, and I will do chesed with this person, whoever it is, on account of Yehonatan, on account of my promise to Yehonatan. Lebeit Shaul Eved, Shaul had a slave, a servant in his house, who shmo Tziva, not a Jewish person. Vayikru lo el David, vayomer hamelech elav hatat Tziva. Are you Tziva? Right? Such has been reported to me. Vayomer avdecha. Right? And he's very careful. You can see the formulation. He says, I am your servant. Right? Making it clear that, you know, he doesn't want to end up on the wrong side of history. He doesn't want to identify himself as an Eved Shaul, right? There's a fear. There's a fear of retribution. So Vayomer HaMelech, David says, Ha'efes od ish lebeit Shaul, is there any survivor? Ve'eseim o chesed Elokim, so that I can do what David calls chesed Elokim. Not just chesed, that was Perek Pasuk Aleph, chesed bavur Yonatan, but chesed Elokim. So the Radak and many others point out, chesed Elokim means it's a reference to the shvua, to the oath that we started with, when David and Yonatan took an oath in the name of God. Vayomer tzival hamelech od bein li honatan nechei raglayim. And Tziva says to David, yeah, Yonatan has a son. And he's disabled. He's not able to walk. Now, the Tziva Mephibosheth relationship is going to be one of the most complicated parts of our study this year. And one can already detect in Tziva's response to David an element of derision towards Mephibosheth, that Tziva is derisive, derogatory towards Mephibosheth. And I say that because David asked, are there survivors in the family? And Siva's response is, Od bein lihonatan, nechei raglayim. Now, ask yourself the following question. What is the relevance exactly of Mephibosheth's disability in this context? So, it's not dispositive on its own. One could argue that maybe Tziva is trying to inspire David to an even greater level of chesed, because after all, this child of Yonatan is really in need, right? There are problems. But even that explanation would be somewhat dubious. After all, David is initiating this conversation. He's very clear that he wants to do chesed. So what we have is a foreshadowing of Tziva trying to position himself vis-a-vis the remnants of Beit Shaul. Let's keep that in mind, not only for tonight, but going forward, that's going to be a very big part of this story. Vayomer lo hamelech. So David says to Tziva, Eifohu, so where is he? And why isn't he with you? Why aren't you taking care of him implicitly? Vayomer Tziva el Hamelech, so Tziva again, who had been, you know, a servant in the house of Shaul. Vayomer Tziva el Hamelech, hinehu beit Machir ben Amiel. He's in the house of a man whom we have not met before in the text, a man of Machir ben Amiel, below Davar. Strange name from a place. The Gemara in Shabbos assumes that this was yet another derogatory remark, below Davar, that basically Mephibosheth is a non-entity. He's in Am Haaretz. The Gemara says Tziva was trying to portray him as an ignoramus. He's not somebody that really is deserving of the king's attention. Vayishlach HaMelech David vayikachehu b'beit Machir ben Amiel. David doesn't even bother responding to Tziva. He takes him milo devar. In fact, the Gemara Maseches Brachos says that Mephibosheth was the greatest scholar of his generation, and that Mephibosheth wasn't even his real name, but it comes from the root of boshet, of embarrassment, that David was habitually embarrassed because Mephibosheth towered over David in terms of scholarship. It's a Gemara in Brachos and Daf Dalet. But anyway, the whole rabbinic subtext here is that there's some kind of antipathy or antagonism between Siva and Mephibosheth. And again, most of this is going to play itself out much later on in the text. Vayavo Mephibosheth ben Yehonatan ben Shaul al David. Mephibosheth is miyuchas. He's linked here by lineage to not only Yonatan, but to Shaul. Vayipol al panav vayishtachu. This is a heartbreaking image. You have somebody who is incapable of walking, so it must have been so difficult for him. And he prostrates himself. Again, he's not a person that can easily pick himself up, right? But his fear of what is about to transpire, that David has sent for him, that itself is kind of heartbreaking. Vayipol al panav vayishtachu. Vayomer David, and David says, Mephibosheth. Vayomer hinei avdecha. Here I am, your servant. There's clearly trepidation. Say Mephibosheth is petrified. And this of course, is apparent to David. Vayomer lo David al tira. Don't be afraid. I'm not here to harm you. Right? This is not what I came for. Ki aso ha'seim chachesed, but rather I am here to keep a promise. Ba'avur Yehonatan avicha. Vahashivoti lechad kol sedei Shaul avicha. And I want to give you all of the land that once belonged to your father, to Shaul. Ve'ata tochal lechem al shulchani tamid. And you will be, literally, a ben bayit, you will be a member of my household, a member of the royal court. Tamid, always. Now, there's a huge discussion in the rabbinic literature. Why exactly was David required to hand over the land of Shaul to Mephibosheth? If Shaul has no sons who are alive, which is true, and Mephibosheth is the grandson, wouldn't he just be the natural Yoresh, the natural inheritor? And we have two primary theories in the Rishonim. One theory is that these lands actually did not belong to Shaul, but they were essentially public property that were granted to the Melech. So the king had certain properties, right? Sort of like, by analogy, what Camp David is in America, right? I mean, Camp David doesn't belong to any particular president. The president has use of Camp David, right? As long as they're president. And there's all kinds of other things. So one theory that we have in the Rishonim is that what David is doing is he's saying, these lands that I have by virtue of my status of the Melech that once belonged to your grandfather, to Shaul, I'm just handing over to you. Now, that's a fascinating possibility. Alternatively, another theory that abounds is that these were actually lands that had belonged to Shaul in terms of the family, not simply based on his royal standing, not Midin HaMelech, but because Ishbosheth was considered Morei B'Malchus, but because Ishbosheth was seen as a kind of a rebel insofar as David was universally recognized as the proper heir to Shaul, and yet Ishbosheth persisted on holding his Malchus for a number of years, somewhere between 2 and 7 years, as we studied. The halacha is that somebody who is a morid mamalchus is a rebel, that property that was theirs becomes the property of the king. And David was handing that back over. So we have two different theories as to why it wouldn't simply accrue to Mephibosheth by virtue of the natural patterns of legal inheritance of Yerusha. But we have here is an unequivocal result. And Mephibosheth goes from being somebody who had to rely on the kindness of this individual, Machir ben Amiel, about whom we know nothing, to somebody who's a person of very substantial means in a matter of moments. And not only is a person of very substantial means, now that David has transferred all of this land to him, all of this property, but he becomes a person of prestige. Right? He goes from being sort of this symbol of the tragedy of the house of Shaul in so many different levels, right? The orphan son, horribly injured, maimed, in the tragedy within the tragedy, and he goes from that to being a member of the royal court. Ve'atato chalachem al shulchani tamid. Va'ishtachu. And once again, Mephibosheth, you know, his life transformed in the instant, bows, prostrates himself. Vayomer me'avdecha. Who am I? This is telling. Ki fanisa el hakelev hames asher kamoni, that you have paid attention to a kelev hames such as I. Kelev hames, it's even hard to translate the words, it's painful, it makes you think about how he felt about himself. A dead dog. Right? Kelev alone would have been noteworthy. Mace alone would have been noteworthy. But you get a little bit of a sense here of Mephibosheth's sense of self and what he's experienced in life up until now. And David, in his kindness towards him, is giving Mephibosheth, obviously, something that was completely shocking to Mephibosheth more than maybe anybody else, a person who had lived a life of a Kelev Hames. Vayikra HaMelech El Tziva. Now Tziva re-enters the narrative. So David calls to Tziva, Nar Shaul, Vayom Reilav Kol Asher Hayal Shaul, and he wants to make it clear as if there was some question about this. And again, Chazal pick up on this, and we'll see it later, that Tziva had designs of his own on this property. And David is going out of his way to say, Kol asher haya l'Shaul, everything that once belonged to Shaul now goes to Mephibosheth. But he doesn't call him Mephibosheth, he calls him Ben Adonecha, the son of your master. Remember, Tziva tried to identify himself as Eved David, sort of aligning himself with the new power. David picked up on that and he resented it. He correctly perceived that Tziva was like this upwardly mobile character, looking to redefine himself as not affiliated with the house of Shaul, but part of the winning team. Right, and everybody thinks in that way, right? Try to be transactional about it. That's the impression you get of Tziva. And what's going on here is the anti-transaction. Right? David is saying, I care about Mephibosheth not because he can do anything for me, but I care about him because I made a promise. And I have a debt. I have a debt towards his father, who saved me. When life was really hard for me. V'avata lo, so David tells Tziva, you will work the land in Hadama, atah uvanecha v'avadecha, v'heveta v'yala ben adonecha lechem, v'achalo, u'mefiboshet ben adonecha yochal tamid lechem al shulchani. And I want you to know that Mephibosheth has now royal protection, and from now on, your relationship with him should be as such. So here again, it's not hard to read between the lines a very, very trenchant critique of Tziva up until this point, where David is saying, why weren't you the one who were taking care of him, right? He obviously needed your help, as Nechei Raglayim. So from now on, you better be responsible towards that. Tziva had, you know, a small army at home of 15 sons, 20 avadim of his own, so 35, you know, people as members of his household. Vayomer Tziva l'melech, k'chol asher yitzaveh Adoni ha-melech et avdo, ken yaseh avdecha, whatever you command me, so shall I do. Umefiboshet ochil al shulchani, ke'achad mibnei ha-melech. And I want you to know that now he, you know, sticks it in, right, once he, you know, figures out which way the winds are blowing, that Mephibosheth, you know, will always be able to eat on my table as well, as if he were one of the king's own children. Of course, David has already told him that, you know, he has an open invitation to the palace, and Tziva is now trying to match that, as it were, trying to make the, give the impression that he, you know, extends the same gratitude, the same graciousness, rather, to Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth ben Katan, Mephibosheth had a very small child of his own, right? Ushmo Micha, v'chol moshav beit Tziva avadim leMephibosheth. David had organized it that now Micha and Mephibosheth had this staff, Tziva in his household. Mephibosheth yoshev b'Yerushalayim. Mephibosheth relocated to Yerushalayim, of course, where David was, you know, had his palace. Ki al shulchan ha-melech tamid hu ochel, because he was, you know, always in the palace. V'hu piseach shtei raglav, and he was, of course, unable to walk. So, you know, the Malbim points out, well, yeah, right, you know, it would be one thing if he was able to, you know, get back and forth quickly. Maybe he would not have to, you know, live in Yerushalayim, but, you know, he wasn't able to move around very quickly, so this meant that he actually fully relocated to Yerushalayim. Okay, so here we have again, as we said, we'll have to keep in mind the conflict, the tension between Tziva and Mephibosheth, between Tziva as this upwardly mobile kind of a figure, right, looking to advance himself relative to Mephibosheth, trying to ingratiate himself with David, and David, you know, sort of picking up on that very, very intuitively, and resenting that, and telling him that, you know, he should have been more faithful to Mephibosheth and to the house of Shaul, and David trying to keep a promise that he had made to Yonatan, in terms of the way that he will treat Mephibosheth. So again, that's all, you know, in terms of what we have on the surface. Now let's take a step back, now that we've studied the text, and think about how this advances our understanding of David as a person. So last week, remember, we were talking about the Chashmonaim, and we were lamenting the sad reality. It is a reality. The sad reality that power changes people. The Chashmonaim, who, you know, had such wonderful ideals of Mikdash, of Tahara, of family unity, who led the Jewish people to such inspirational victory, became intoxicated by power, and they ended up in a civil war with each other, desecrating the Mikdash, and far from embodying any kind of spiritual purity, they had completely, right, become Hellenized, Hyrcanus Varistabalus, as we studied last week. And they were annihilated as a result. So that is not the exception, as we tried to point out. That is the norm. The norm is that people who become powerful, right, become intoxicated by that, and it fundamentally changes the way that they interact with other people. What this chapter is about is not just Mephibosheth and keeping a particular promise to Yonatan, important as that is. This chapter foundationally advances our understanding of who David is as a person. right? In chapter 8, what we read about was David as a national figure. David, Melech, Chol Kol Yisrael, and he's Osa Mishparut Stakal Chol Amo. But what's fascinating is this chapter, chapter 9, gives us a window into who David is as a person. And the answer is, he's actually still the same person. Right? The big reveal of this chapter is that David has not changed. That power has not corrupted him. And he still identifies very, very deeply with that moment when he was in grave danger in a field, hungry, hiding, and Yonatan comes out and says, you know, you're going to have to run. My father's out to get you. He saves David's life. And David never forgot that. And he proactively seeks out, finds Mephibosheth, a self-described Kelev Hames, and he treats him with dignity and then some. This tells us a great deal about who David is. Let me just establish a contrast, not just with the Chashmonaim, you know, reading the Parshios of Yosef. So let me give you a great example of this. The Sar HaMashkim, right? Torah tells us that after Yosef pled with the Sar HaMashkim to help him, right? He had served the Sar HaMashkim for a full year in prison. Everybody skips over that detail. He didn't just interpret the guy's dream. But he'd been taking care of him for a year. Vayasharet Osam, the Torah tells us. Vayu Yamim B'Mishmar, they were there for a full year. He interprets his dream for him. He alleviates his anxiety. And Yosef says, you know, you'll be a powerful person. You'll be a member of the cabinet. You could probably move things around a little bit. Kim zechartani itcha kasher yitavlach. And the Sar HaMashkim is conspicuously silent in response. Doesn't say anything. No. At that point, you could say, he's waiting to see what happens. But then the Torah tells us, and this is an indictment, V'lo zachar Sar HaMashkim es Yosef v'yishkachehu. What's the double language all about? V'lo zachar v'yishkachehu. It's quite clear. Maybe Ibn Ezra says it, but I'll just paraphrase it and put a finer point on this. That the Sar HaMashkim was humiliated, right? That he could have ever needed the help of a person he would later describe as a Na'ar, an Ivri, an Eved. He was humiliated and mortified by that period in his life when he was vulnerable, when he was incarcerated, when he didn't know whether or not he would live to tell the story. And the fact that, you know, there was this person who had helped him, who happened to be, you know, and again, from the Egyptian perspective, how humiliating, right? In Ivri, because they looked down on them as members of an inferior culture. In Eved, a slave, not that Yosef had done anything, you know, wrong to become a slave, a Na'ar. And here he is, this, you know, important person, this cabinet official, right? Probably has his own, you know, driver or something, you know, an expense account. He's, after all, a member of the cabinet. And that he was reduced to needing the help of this person is a source of profound mortification. So it's not like he happened to forget. It's a very active, for, you know, choice to forget. V'lo zachar sar mashkim es Yosef v'yishkachehu. I'll give you a halachic analogy. The Rambam says, what's the iser, what's the prohibition in the Torah of forgetting of Amalek? It says, Zachor lo tishkach. So Zachor, we understand. You're supposed to actively remember once a year, we parsha Zachor, fine. What's lo tishkach? So the Rambam says, it doesn't mean you happen to forget. It means, lahashlich sinaso ve'evaso milibeinu. It means to dissociate yourself. To say, you know, I'm not really interested in this, you know, whatever ancient skirmish between this nomadic clan in the desert that attacked the Jews on their way out of Egypt. It's dissociation from Jewish history that's the mechayev, that is the offense. Lo zachar sar mashkim esosei v'yishkecheu. You know what that means? It means that the sar hamashkim was mortified, he was humiliated by his contingency, by his dependency on this person that he deemed inferior, right, in all of these ways, culturally, racially, etc. And so, you know, he erased that portion of his life. And that, again, that's not the exception, that's the norm. That's how people in an upwardly mobile society function. So David is the opposite, right? David had this period in his life that he was completely vulnerable, he was hungry, he was running, right? And instead of trying to erase that, right, David actively honors that and the promises that were made. And here he is, right, at the height of his powers, and he's perfectly willing to acknowledge and act in accordance with the simple fact that he would never be where he was had it not been for Yonatan. So what is this chapter about? That's really what it's about. The point of a Perek Tes in a sentence is to say, power didn't change David. Power didn't change him. And that's what separates him. David's not perfect. David will commit sins, sometimes grievous sins. But the legacy of David, those of us who've been studying Tehillim together, we've been talking a lot about this now for, you know, almost a year, since March. You read this in Tehillim. Basically, the thing about David is that he's authentic. God appreciates that. Karov Hashem l'chol, karov l'chol asher yikru ve'emes. As long as you can be honest. And God is always talking about how David's heart is pure with him. Again, he makes mistakes. But his fundamental core personality is decent, is earnest. And the mistakes that he makes are mistakes that he regrets, he repents, he feels genuine remorse. Something incredibly compelling about him, about David. And this is part of it. That he's unchanged by power, that there's some immutable core. He's not vacuous, right? There's something there. There's character. It's real. It's real. Right? That's a commodity in life, right? You meet people, right? Especially, you know, in people in positions of power, this is an even greater phenomenon, but it's not limited to them, right? It's easy to pick on the politicians. They make it easy sometimes, but, you know, the truth is that, you know, you find this in other walks of life, right? And you're speaking to somebody wondering, is there something actually here? Or is this person's goal in life just to, you know, kind of, you know, continue to advance themselves in whatever area they deem to be important? Again, so socially, you know, upwardly mobile, materially upward, socioeconomically upwardly, right? They're just trying to sort of, like, you know, every interaction for them is an opportunity for them to try to, you know, better position themselves, sort of like the character that Siva's playing in this chapter. And David is refreshing to us and to God because he's not that way. And that's why Hashem chose him, because he was there. He was an afterthought. His father and family disregarded him. Right, he was in Nanaveh, Im Hatzon, taking care of the sheep, unpretentious, and he remains unpretentious. And a promise made is a promise that has to be kept. Loyalty is real. Mephibosheth, by his own self-description, is a Kelev Hames. He lives off of other people's kindness. He has nothing to offer David. David grants him not only material security, not only personal security, but dignity. Makes him a member of the royal court. And he can't get anything from Mephibosheth. David's an authentic person. There's something there. There's real character. And that character somehow is able to remain constant even when cloaked in enormous power. Man, that is exceptionally rare. Very exceptionally rare in life. And you have to ask yourself, how many people that you knew or that you know, once, quote unquote, they've been Ola Ligdula, they've achieved positions of whatever it is, in whatever field, how many of them are the same people they once were? Ask yourself that question. How many of them remember? How many of them are the Sar HaMashkim who, you know, all of those times when they were really in need of help, they've successfully whitewashed from the official history, from their own personal narrative. And how many of them are David? He's the exception. David is the exception. He is the Roeh Ne'eman. He's the faithful shepherd. And the capacity to honor the promise to Yonatan, especially with this self-described Kelev Hames, Nechei Raglayim, a person forgotten by society. That's David at his finest. So from this point on, of course, you know, we're going to, you know, enter the narrative of David's greatest failure that will haunt him, you know, for the rest of his life, essentially, with Bathsheba. And it's important for us, you know, as we embark on that study, and it's a very important study, there's no question. It's important for us to go into that entire chapter of David's life with a recognition that David never claimed to be perfect. That's not who he is as a biblical figure. It's not about perfection. But there is something profoundly authentic about him as a person. There are true values there. And doesn't mean he's incapable of mistakes or grievous mistakes, horrible mistakes. That will haunt him. But the fact is that they do haunt him because there's something there, because character matters. And that's what makes it so compelling. So that's what we're going to, of course, begin to start to talk about next week, is the context of that sin, the ramifications of that sin. It's really multiple sins. But in the end of the day, this chapter being where it is, after David has achieved the height of his power, the fact that he still feels obligated to a promise made, that is an essential part of our understanding of what makes David the paradigmatic leader of the Jewish people and the paradigmatic king, unchanged, uncorrupted, even by enormous power. So God willing, next week, same time, we'll talk about David, and the initial steps into the sin of David and Bathsheba, which will dominate the rest of Shmuel Bet effectively. Eva, go ahead.
We learn more about Micah, story.